American Free Press Audio Edition, number 13 and 14, March 25, April 1, 2019. Morris D. Sacked SPLC Sleazeball Scent Packing, by Mark Anderson. Morris D.'s, the disreputable hate peddler who has for many years posed as the archenemy of hate, was fired from his position as head of the infamous Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, in Montgomery, Alabama. The SPLC is reviled among thinking Americans as an anti-free speech, anti-Christian, anti-conservative pressure group that has accused everyone from President Donald Trump to this newspaper, and many publications, organizations, and individuals in between, of being aligned with dangerous extremism. The firing of Dees, now 82, who co-founded the SPLC in 1971, was effective March 13. SPLC President Richard Cohen was tight-lipped about the specifics, but he did say it had to do with misconduct of an unspecified nature. As a civil rights organization, the SPLC is committed to ensuring that the conduct of our staff reflects the mission of the organization and the values we hope to instill in the world, Cohen said in a statement. In the Montgomery Advertiser, Dees was quoted as saying, "I refuse to say anything negative about the center or its employees. I let my life's work and reputation speak for itself." His life's work speaks for itself. Indeed, in 1994, Dees was accused of mistreating the organization's minority employees who said they felt threatened and banded together, as local media reported at the time. Even while the SPLC has preached nonstop that the slightest alleged misstep against minorities is on par with a KKK lynching. Worst of all, Dees molded the SPLC into a rogue agency, which, armed with its hate-watch list and map of alleged hate groups, has routinely blacklisted scores of individuals and organizations while acting as a dominant source of information for media, law enforcement, and many large corporations. That appears to be the SPLC's core function: erode and destroy the constitutional rights and reputations of most conservatives and constitutionalists, and criminalize right-wing free speech and assembly, all behind the smokescreen of being a civil rights litigation and education center. Although this is the very antithesis of fairness and objectivity, most media have continued to trust the SPLC's analyses. At least one newsman sees the truth: Jim Farp, the Advertiser's managing editor in 1994 when the story broke on the SPLC mistreating minority staffers, said of Dees's firing, "I would hope the IRS and the Justice Department would take this as an opportunity to come in and take a close look at the center's finances. It's long overdue." In response to the SPLC's announcement that it had settled a defamation lawsuit brought by Quilliam International, a group that works to fight anti-Muslim bigotry and Islamist extremism, for nearly $3.4 million. Family Research Council President Tony Perkins responded by saying that the SPLC's falsehoods and dangerous tactics have finally caught up with them. Even after this massive payout, the SPLC continues to sit on hundreds of millions of dollars, much of it offshore, that they use to advance their liberal policy agenda. This public acknowledgement of their defamatory actions leaves the media and big business with no excuse in continuing to use the SPLC as an objective, independent source. APERSONALMESSAGEFROMTHEEDITOR, Conservatives Not Responsible for Mosque Massacre. On March 15, in the quiet city of Christchurch, New Zealand, a 28-year-old man opened fire inside two mosques in the span of about 20 minutes, murdering 50 people and injuring another 50. According to reports, he had intentionally timed his attacks so that they took place during afternoon prayers so he could ensure that the maximum number of victims, innocent men, women, and children, would be present. Unlike in many previous mass shootings, however, this time the police were able to catch the crazed killer, an Australian by the name of Brenton Tarrant. He is currently cooling his heels behind bars, has been slapped with multiple murder charges, and will likely spend the rest of his life in prison. This terrible incident should have been reported as a horrible tragedy carried out by a violent, crazy person, but that's not what's been happening. Instead, The mainstream media and far-left-wing activists have been cynically misrepresenting what happened to point an accusatory finger at conservatives, critics of immigration, President Donald Trump, and, of course, white people in general, all because the lunatic shooter was a white male. For the most part, the already brainwashed masses have bought into this narrative, accepting without question the claim that white extremism is on the rise around the world and that, now, anyone who has ever spoken out or called for limiting immigration at some point in time bears responsibility for this heinous act. In reality, though, the truth is very far from what you may have read in the big media. How do we know this? For one thing, the suspect who has been arrested for carrying out this heinous crime took the time to post to the internet a 16,000-word, 74-page manifesto explaining why he did it. It's worth pausing for a second to note that Terrence Screed is utter garbage. A better way to characterize it would be as a poorly written, babbling, virtually incomprehensible, self-important rant presented in an awkward question and answer format often referred to on the internet as infrequently asked questions, or frequently asked questions, though social media outlets and governments have tried to scrub Terrence's lengthy screed. It's still widely available under the name The Great Replacement, and anyone anywhere in the world can read it in its entirety if they were so inclined. Even a quick glance at Terrence's writings reveals that the man is, to put it mildly, nuts. While the media has painted Terrence as a far-right white nationalist, the truth is evident, when one reads his manifesto, that it's impossible to really know what the guy is talking about. Given the fact that he bizarrely characterizes himself as both an ethno-nationalist and an eco-fascist, whatever that is, he follows that up by trying to clarify his outlook, to wit, ethnic autonomy for all peoples with a focus on the preservation of nature, sic, and the natural order. Then he adds, the nation with the closest political and social values to my own is the People's Republic of China. He then asks himself, were you right-wing? He responds, depending on the definition, sure. Following that, he asks, were you left-wing? To which he answers the same way, depending on the definition, sure. And while he does invoke Trump, it is ironically the media's caricature of Trump that Tarrant really clings to, asking himself, were you a supporter of Donald Trump? His response, as a symbol of renewed white identity and common purpose, sure. As a policymaker and leader, dear God no. A few lines later, Tarrant pulls the veil back to show his kookiness, saying he expects that eventually he will be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, as it was awarded to the terrorist Nelson Mandela once his own people achieved victory and took power. And if he is caught, he adds, I expect to be freed in 27 years from my incarceration, the same number of years as Mandela, for the same crime. Perhaps most ridiculous of all is that, when he asks himself who out there has radicalized him and made him the insane killer that he is today, he cites Candace Owens, a 29-year-old black woman, who has grown in popularity on the internet in the past few years, because she's a rational, reasonable conservative. To any objective observer, the whole thing just reads like one sick, twisted joke. It's a huge waste of time to pore over it, but, sadly, it needs to be done because so many people out there are cherry-picking parts of it for the purpose of reinforcing the sad, tired accusation that white people, especially conservative white people, are really the biggest threat in the world today. The good news is that there appears to be pushback against this from many freethinkers out there, like all of us here at American Free Press, who refuse to be cowed by those who shamelessly exploit a tragedy to win political points. Christopher J. Petherick, executive editor, left-wing censorship group slapped popular talk show host gives thought police a taste of their own medicine, by John Friend, television talk show host Tucker Carlson, one of the most popular cable news commentators on air today and a strong critic of globalism, mass immigration, forced multiculturalism, and other key tenets of the prevailing liberal, politically correct social order, has been targeted by radical left-wing groups and activists for months now. As this newspaper has previously reported, radical Antifa activists targeted the outspoken America First populist home in the Washington, D.C. area in November of last year. Several members of Smash Racism D.C., a radical left-wing Antifa-affiliated group, posted Carlson's home address online and organized a protest outside his residence to denounce his alleged racism and bigotry. Others have organized boycotts of his program and have attempted to entice advertisers on both Fox News and Carlson's flagship nightly news program, Tucker Carlson Tonight, to end their business relationship with the network. Media Matters, a highly partisan and far left-wing organization that regularly targets and attacks conservatives, has been and continues to be one of the primary organizations operating both behind the scenes and publicly to sabotage Carlson's nightly news program and tarnish his reputation. The activist organization recently published and highlighted a number of controversial statements Carlson made years ago relating to women, minorities, and other topics in a dishonest effort to distort what Carlson actually meant and further tarnish his reputation. Carlson commendably did not back down in the face of such a dishonest and highly partisan smear campaign. Media Matters caught me saying something naughty on a radio show more than a decade ago, Carlson said in response to the Media Matters hit piece. Rather than express the usual ritual contrition, how about this? I'm on television every weeknight live for an hour. If you want to know what I think, you can watch. Anyone who disagrees with my views is welcome to come on and explain why. Indeed, in response to the attacks, Carlson has used his platform to launch his own investigation into the dishonest left-wing groups and individuals that have so brazenly attacked him and Fox News in an effort to deplatform them and sabotage their reputations. In recent episodes of his nightly news program, Carlson has aired segments exposing the groups working tirelessly to end his career, including Media Matters, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and CNN, among others. Carlson recently revealed that the current president of Media Matters, Angelo Carusone, has a history of making derogatory and disparaging comments. Unsurprisingly, Carusone's controversial statements have garnered little attention or outrage among Media Matters' liberal supporters. On his now-defunct blog, Carlson used a number of slurs to characterize transvestites and minorities, including Jews, according to a report from the Daily Caller, which dug up Carlson's old blog using the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine. Carlson has referred to transvestites as trannies and Japanese people as Japs, long considered an ethnic slur. Carlson, who is homosexual, even invoked classic anti-Semitic tropes when describing his Jewish boyfriend's political convictions, writing that his boyfriend was conservative as a result of possessing several bags of Jewish gold. Typically, these statements would have leftists worked up into a lather, working overtime to get the individual fired. The mainstream media would have reported heavily on the politically incorrect verbiage, interviewing top officials at the SPLC and other organizations, who would have condemned the speaker in no uncertain terms. A look at media reports reveals that only Fox News picked up the story, and Carusone remains the president of Media Matters. Countless conservatives and principled supporters of Carlson have rallied to his defense, expressing outrage at the increasingly tyrannical and dishonest tactics used by the radical left to silence and shut down their political rivals. The anti-Tucker outrage mob is so clearly acting hypocritically and in bad faith for purely partisan political reasons. Donald Trump Jr. recently stated, Ned Ryan, the CEO of American Majority, correctly noted that Media Matters exists solely to take out conservatives in media and politics. They're a partisan hit squad trying to delegitimize and deplatform conservatives. Serious-minded people should understand this is political warfare and tell Media Matters to go pound sand, Ryan stated. Christopher Cantwell, a libertarian-leaning podcaster and commentator, in a recent podcast praised Carlson's resolve in refusing to bow down to Media Matters and the radical left. What makes Carlson more dangerous to the left than any other single thing is that he understands their long game, Cantwell stated. Those who apologize today will be paralyzed tomorrow, because the goal of the mob is not redemption, but submission. One who can be made to bow to their whims will invariably be conscripted into their service, and Tucker simply will not permit this to happen to him under any circumstances. For now, Carlson and Fox News are not only holding out and refusing to bend to the pressure being brought by these dishonest outfits, They are actively fighting back against the left-wing outrage mob. Supreme Court can write past wrongs. Will Bladensburg, MD, Peace Cross be the next Christian symbol to be ripped down? By Dave Gahery. The 40-foot-tall Bladensburg Peace Cross, located less than 15 miles from this newspaper's headquarters, was built in 1925 to honor local military men who died in World War I. Now, it is under attack by some strange birds from Bladensburg, MD, supported by the American Humanist Association, AHA, a U.S. nonprofit whose main mission seems to be removing any and all references to religion and God from the public square. Founded in 1941, the AHA lawyers up those whose constitutional rights are allegedly breached, actively lobbies Congress on the mythologized concept of church-state separation, and does a whole lot of other things that poison our constitutional republic. The mothers of these 49 Maryland soldiers who paid the ultimate price for their country over 100 years ago designed the memorial to mirror the crosses that mark graves in American cemeteries overseas. A plaque reads, "This memorial cross dedicated to the heroes of Prince George's County who gave their lives in the Great War for the liberty of the world and lists the names of the dead, a sweet piece of history obviously lost on Fred Edwards and Stephen Lowe, who are particularly offended by the memorial. Never mind that almost all of the boys and girls who served and continue to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces are Christians." In 1961, after a highway was built around it, the Peace Cross was deeded to the Maryland National Capitol Park and Planning Commission and stood there without controversy until 51 years later, when the aforementioned ill-advised snowflakes sued, arguing that they are offended by the government's endorsement of religion and the fact that the cross is maintained with taxpayer money. A district court ruled for the cross at that time, but 5 years later, the Richmond, Va.-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit reversed the decision, ruling that the government had excessively entangled itself with religion. Of course, the enemies of the Republic are using the document meant to amend the newly created U.S. Constitution, the so-called Bill of Rights, in particular the first 16 words from Amendment 1, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances." Although the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause are still debated by constitutional scholars, there is no question that God and religion were central in the lives of our founding fathers, so much so that James Madison Jr., the fourth U.S. President, 1809-1817, known as the Father of the Constitution, wrote near the end of his life that belief in God was essential to the moral order of the world. As Mark R. Levin explained in Men in Black, How the Supreme Court is Destroying America, 2005, at the time of the ratification of the Constitution, America was an extremely religious nation. The framers, he wrote, never envisioned a time where the mention of God in the public square would be controversial, let alone illegal in certain circumstances. In fact, said Levin, the historical record is filled with examples of officials of the federal government invoking God during the same period that the Bill of Rights was ratified. So how did we get to the point that the mere mention of God in the same sentence as the more government causes many to cringe? It all began at the turn of the 19th century, when the Danbury, Con, Baptist Association sent a letter on October 7, 1801 to President Thomas Jefferson, expressing concern over the lack in their state constitution of explicit protection of religious liberty, and against a government establishment of religion. Jefferson wrote back on January 1, 1802, saying in part, "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." Fast forward to the middle of the 20th century, when in 1947 U.S. Supreme Court, Scotus, Justice Hugo Black, a Ku Klux Klan member and longtime admirer of Jefferson, revived a previously obscure metaphor from Jefferson's writings, and upended the long-standing balance between the government and religion in Everson v. Board of Education. In his 1802 letter, Jefferson was merely explaining why he didn't support national days of fasting and Thanksgiving, as George Washington and John Adams, his predecessors in office, had done, not defining any wall of separation. Despite this, wrote Levin, the wall is part of the lexicon of many Supreme Court cases that involve religion, and it has led to an inconsistent and illogical series of decisions, like 1962's Engle v. Vittel, a controversial and dubious decision that was at odds with American history, which outlawed state-sponsored prayer, 1992's Levy v. Weissmann, which ruled that schools can't sponsor clerics to conduct any type of prayer, or 2004's Elk Grove Unified School District v. Newdow, where the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled the Pledge of Allegiance ran afoul of the Establishment Clause. Of course, as Levin explains in his fine book, this clause was never intended to ban the invocation of God in public forums or the voluntary participation in ceremonies or rites that recognize God. In other words, it was never intended to create a strict wall of separation between church and state, a term that, of course, appears nowhere in the U.S. Constitution. Significantly, Scotus's decision could impact similar memorials in towns across the country and even Arlington National Cemetery, states a February 26 CNN article. The National Cemetery holds two crosses, one a 13-foot-tall Latin cross called the Argonne Cross, dedicated in 1923 to the memory of our men in France, and a 24-foot-tall Canadian cross of sacrifice, donated by the Canadian government to honor Americans who died in war. While the Trump administration has voiced support for the Peace Cross, Scottish justices typically pay little mind to political preferences. Scottish heard oral arguments on February 27, and we can expect a decision by late June. Whistleblower jailed yet again. Former Army intelligence analyst who released 730,000 damning documents arrested by St. Patrick. In a country that relishes every opportunity to tout its First Amendment freedoms to the rest of the world, no American had ever spent more than 3 years in jail for exposing government secrets to the public. That was before Chelsea Manning spent 7 years imprisoned for doing just that, exercising what Manning believes to be First Amendment freedoms of speech in the press in an effort to inform average Americans of what was really happening within their government's perpetual war state. Today, Manning is behind bars once again for refusing to testify against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange before a grand jury. In 2009, Manning was assigned as an intelligence analyst to an army unit in Iraq. A year later, Manning released classified videos and documents to WikiLeaks. In total, more than 251,000 diplomatic cables and 482,000 army reports, the Iraq war logs, were released. Manning was arrested and prosecuted after threat analyst and hacker Adrian Lamo, a friend of Manning's, reported the releases to the Army's Criminal Investigation Command. Manning was acquitted of aiding the enemy, which could have brought a death sentence, but was still sentenced to 35 years in prison at the maximum security facility at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. In January 2017, President Barack Obama commuted Manning's sentence to 7 years dating back to the May 2010 arrest. Manning has remained a controversial figure, both in the media and on college campuses. In September 2017, Manning was named a visiting fellow at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, after complaints were levied by former acting director of the CIA Michael Morell and then CIA director Mike Pompeo. Harvard rescinded its offer to Manning. "I'm not ashamed of being disinvited. I view that just as much of an honor distinction as the fellowship itself," Manning said. "This is military intelligence, and it is a police state in which we can no longer engage in actual political discourse in our institutions." After refusing to testify against Assange in early March, U.S. District Judge Claude Hilton ordered that Manning be imprisoned for contempt of court. There was a brief hearing in which Manning re-emphasized a refusal to testify. Then Manning bravely told the judge, "I will accept whatever you bring upon me." Manning has logical objections for refusing to testify before the grand jury. Manning objects to the secretive process of grand juries and has already revealed everything at a court-martial hearing. Second, the grand jury process has often been used to entrap and persecute activists for protected political speech. Third, because prosecutors granted Manning immunity for testimony at the court-martial hearing, Manning's ability to invoke the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination no longer applies, thus eliminating any constitutional protections. With every case that comes to court hereafter, being called to testify means once again opening Manning to new charges. It's a twisted, legal way of continually persecuting someone for actions stemming from the same offense. Manning will be in jail now until the grand jury has finished its investigation. While the military and media establishment could have controlled the Manning story 40 to 50 years ago, pre-internet, the rise of the alternative media means that different perspectives of each story can be aired unedited. No longer can someone be so easily labeled a traitor. Whistleblowers exist in the vacuum where the mainstream media has failed. Whistleblowers like Manning, Assange, former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, and former FBI agent Colleen Rowley now inform the public more in one courageous action than CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and the major networks do in a year. Writing for Consortium News, former British ambassador to Uzbekistan Craig Murray supported Manning's decision not to testify. "I am in awe of Chelsea's courage in refusing to testify, and shocked at a system that imprisons somebody for contempt of court for maintaining dignified silence," Murray wrote. "Chelsea has also done a great service in finally stripping away the last vestige of excuse from the figures who refused to support Julian Assange, pretending that they do not believe he faces extradition to the United States, and that the legal issue is not about WikiLeaks' right to publish." Prosecutors have said that the Assange grand jury has no link to the investigation of Robert Mueller, though both would have a shared interest in seeing Assange prosecuted. Amazon bans more books by respected scholars. Author suggests putting Jeff Bezos on trial for treason. By Dr. Kevin Barrett, the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America, and American tradition, enshrines freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Nowhere is this more evident than in the book publishing industry. Historically, few books have been banned or restricted in America for any reason other than obscenity or indecency, and even those restrictions have largely collapsed. Since the mid-1960s, a book can only be banned if a reasonable person would consider it prurient, in violation of contemporary community standards, and completely devoid of literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. But since 2017, our tradition of freedom from book censorship has been annihilated. We are living through the worst ever assault on the Bill of Rights. This crime is being committed by a monopoly in service to an organized crime syndicate, Amazon, under pressure from the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, and allied groups, has kindled the biggest book-burning bonfire ever. And the books Amazon is burning are not those brimming with obscenity. You can still buy the Marcus de Sade's pornographic incitements to rape, torture, and murder, alongside thousands of similar abominations, on Amazon. What you can't buy are scholarly books that carefully and dispassionately document facts that pose a threat to the continued reign of what certain hotheads have, not entirely inaccurately, called ZOG, the Zionist Occupation Government. On March 11, Amazon, which holds an effective monopoly on book sales in the United States, notified Professor Kevin MacDonald that two of his scholarly books, The Culture of Critique and Separation and Its Discontents, had been banned. "During our review process, we found that this content is in violation of our content guidelines. As a result, we cannot offer this book for sale." What content, specifically? Which guidelines did it violate, and how? MacDonald reports. In subsequent emails, they just keep repeating that these books were found to violate content guidelines, even though I pointed out that they were published 21 years ago by a respected academic publisher. No specifics. No appeal process. Amazon doesn't just ban scholarly works by professors who advocate for white people. America's leading pro-black people historical research team, the Nation of Islam, NOI, research group, has also been the victim of an Amazon book-burning bonfire. In his article American Pravda, Amazon Book Censorship, Banning Black Historiography. During Black History Month, Ron Unz discusses Amazon's scandalous banning of the NOI Research Group's multi-volume series The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. Volume 3 of that series convincingly exposes the ADL as an organized crime syndicate founded to protect the Jewish rapist and murderer Leo Frank. Though I do not agree with MacDonald or NOI about everything, I cannot help but recognize that their banned books feature high-quality scholarship. The same cannot be said of the rapidly Islamophobic books of Daniel Pipes, Robert Spencer, and a long list of other Zionist-funded propagandists who together make up the $50 million per year Islamophobia industry. Though almost uniformly characterized by poor scholarship and reckless animosity to the people they write about, these authors are not only allowed to sell their deceptive and hateful wares on Amazon but are relentlessly promoted by Zionist big money. In other words, essentially the same organized crime syndicate is forcing Amazon to ban dispassionate scholarly works as hate, while simultaneously spending hundreds of millions of dollars promoting actual hate propaganda sold by the boatload on Amazon. Spencer, the Zionist paid hate propagandist who inspired child murderer Anders Breivik, is peddling 37 very bad books on Amazon. At least 9 editions of Hitler's Mein Kampf are likewise being sold there. Thousands of books that offend modern liberal sensibilities are equally available. So are books that offend traditional conservative sensibilities. And that is as it should be. Two-bit hate hacks like Spencer, as well as important historical figures like Hitler, should be refuted, not silenced. And speaking of Hitler, the current wave of Amazon censorship began 2 years ago with the wholesale banning of revisionist books about World War II. On March 6, 2017, Amazon banned 68 titles from Castle Hill Publishers, which specializes in scientific and forensic historical investigations. Jerma Rudolph of Castle Hill asserts that his company was not the only one targeted, and that, in fact, hundreds of revisionist history books were banned that day. Our Constitution, and the tradition of liberty it enshrines, is being shredded, but there is a simple solution. Force Amazon to respect the Bill of Rights. Like Facebook, Twitter, and Google, Amazon has a monopoly in the digital public square. It is a de facto public utility, not a private company. If Jeff Bezos keeps spitting on our Constitution, we must nationalize Amazon and try Bezos for treason. Will Thought Censors Win? By Paul Craig Roberts. The internet is seen as a savior that will take over the function of honest reporting and free speech now that the print and TV media serve as the ministry of propaganda. This is true only if people migrate from Google, Facebook, Twitter, and so forth, to the alternatives that do not block content at odds with official explanations. Unfortunately, people tend to be stuck in their ways. They are accustomed to Google, Facebook, and Twitter, don't know of the alternatives, and if they did, are disinclined to spend their time to set up differently. Liberal America created a society that is heavily into denunciation, a primary function of social media. Even icons of the left are denounced when they fall behind the pace of hatred set by identity politics. Identity politics refers to the left's push to form political groupings around racial, religious, ethnic, social, or cultural identity instead of adhering to more traditional, broad-based party politics that disregard special interests for the good of the country. As for free speech, Western society has reached the point where anyone who expresses an opinion finds themselves groveling in apologies. Debate is non-existent. A person's opinions are fashioned for the person, who still has to be careful to express the current opinion of the moment and not yesterday's version or the one an hour ago. The result is an unsupporting milieu for truth. In the 21st century Western world, it is impossible to tell the truth and not be demonized. Demonization of truth scares away those who have been taught that they cannot have an opinion of their own. If the American people, indeed the Western world, are to have a future, it will be due to websites that promote unfettered debate. Truth has never had an easy time, but in the 21st century there is an all-out war against truth. Agendas are prevailing over truth. People need to support the few places truth can still be found. In the 20th century there were liberal and conservative philanthropic foundations that supported the First Amendment and dissident opinion. No more, the conservative foundations have fallen to the neoconservatives and their agenda of American and Israeli hegemony. The liberal foundations have been aligned with identity politics and pump money into the destruction of social cohesion. There is no big money for truth. The task of supporting truth lies with ordinary everyday people. House passes intolerance resolution. Comments by Muslim legislators spur Congress to violate spirit of First Amendment. By John Friend. On March 7, just after AFP went to press, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a resolution condemning anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim discrimination, and bigotry against minorities as hateful expressions of intolerance that are contrary to the values and aspirations of the United States. The resolution, the second such resolution approved by the House in the past 2 months that explicitly denounces anti-Semitism, came in response to comments made by Rep. Ilhan Omar Demin, a Somali-born freshman congresswoman who has been critical of the pro-Israel lobby and the potential dual loyalty members of Congress hold in relation to Israel. Omar's statements have been widely condemned by government officials, congressional representatives, media pundits, and political commentators across the political spectrum as anti-Semitic in nature. Despite the entirely legitimate points she has raised, it is important to note that Omar never once mentioned Jew or Jewish in either of her purportedly controversial statements. Omar first ran afoul of the pro-Israel lobby and its supporters in Washington when she said support for Israel and its powerful lobby was all about the Benjamins, that is, Benjamin Franklin as he is pictured on a $100 bill, meaning the huge donations legislators receive from the pro-Israel community. On March 3, Omar again ran into trouble when she took to Twitter in response to comments made by Rep. Nita Lowy, DNY, that Omar had mischaracterized support for Israel. Omar tweeted, "I should not be expected to have allegiance pledge support to a foreign country in order to serve my country in Congress or serve on committee." The recently passed resolution expressly condemns the so-called anti-Semitic trope regarding dual loyalties, arguing that such accusations generally have an insidious and pernicious history, whether from the political right, center, or left. Bigotry, discrimination, oppression, racism, and imputations of dual loyalty threaten American democracy and have no place in American political discourse, the resolution declares. It goes on to explicitly denounce white supremacists, citing the Unite the Right rally as an alleged violent manifestation of white supremacy. The mass shooting at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, SC in June 2015 carried out by a young man with white nationalist views, and the more recent mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh carried out by a radicalized man who reportedly stated he wanted all Jews to die. The resolution describes anti-Semitism as a centuries old bigotry and form of racism faced by Jews simply because they are Jews, and states that it is a foreign policy priority of the United States to monitor and combat anti-Semitism abroad. Earlier this year, President Donald Trump appointed Ella Carr, a Jewish former prosecutor based in Los Angeles, to serve as the special envoy for monitoring and combating anti-Semitism, an official position in the State Department which was created by law and designed to protect the Jewish people throughout the world. According to Carr, the position had been left unfilled by the Trump administration for the previous 2 years. The House resolution passed by a vote of 407-23, with Rep. Steve King, R. Iowa, simply voting present. The 23 no votes came exclusively from Republicans, including notable figures such as Liz Cheney, Arroyo, Mo Brooks, RNY, Mike Conway, R. Texas, and Lee Zeldin, RNY, among others. The resolution was initially designed to exclusively denounce anti-Semitism and to call Omar out by name as trafficking in anti-Semitic tropes that are contrary to American values. After pushback from a number of progressive Democratic allies of Omar, the resolution evolved into a broader denunciation of multiple forms of bigotry and discrimination, including anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and other forms of discrimination against minorities, prompting the no votes from Republicans. The pro-Israel community also expressed mixed emotions to the resolution. with some organizations and leaders praising the bill and others more critical. The Anti-Defamation League praised the resolution. ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt, whose organization pressured House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to take action, announced his organization was pleased that the House took a firm stance against anti-Semitism, including making an explicit statement rejecting the pernicious myth of dual loyalty and other vile slurs that have been used to persecute Jews for centuries, according to a press release issued by the organization. The Simon Wiesenthal Center, on the other hand, was critical of the resolution. "While we commend Speaker Nancy Pelosi's decision to bring to the floor the issue of anti-Semitism within its ranks, the politically expedient resolution failed to call out Representative Omo by name and failed to take into account the historically unique dimensions of the anti-Semitic themes trafficked by Rep. Omar," the organization said in a statement. "Israeli accountability begins now. Spying for the Israeli government has turned into a get-out-of-jail-free card," by Philip Giraldi, "recently returning to the U.S. on a flight from Venice. 2 Bored to Read syndrome drove me to watch a movie. I chose Bohemian Rhapsody, which recently won an Academy Award for lead actor Rami Malek, who truly did turn in a memorable performance in a film that was otherwise plodding and predictable. As the credits were rolling, I noticed that the movie's executive producer was none other than Arnon Milchan, an Israeli media billionaire who has spent most of his career in Hollywood. My immediate thought was, why is this scumbag still making movies in Hollywood? Why isn't he in jail? Milchan earned my opprobrium the easy way, by spying for Israel to the detriment of the country that has made him rich and relatively famous, which is the United States of America. The Milchan tale is just one part of the successful effort by Israel to obtain the technology and raw materials for its secret nuclear arsenal. Preventing nuclear proliferation was a major objective of the U.S. government when, in the early 1960s, President John F. Kennedy learned from a CIA report that Tel Aviv was developing a nuclear weapon. He told the Israelis to terminate their program or risk losing American political and economic support, but was killed before any steps were taken to end the project. Israel always features prominently in the annual FBI report called Foreign Economic Collection and Industrial Espionage. The 2005 report stated that Israel has an active program to gather proprietary information within the United States. These collection activities are primarily directed at obtaining information on military systems and advanced computing applications that can be used in Israel's sizable armaments industry. The Mossad frequently uses so-called Sayanim in its espionage, which means diaspora Jews that it recruits on the basis of a shared religion or concern for the security of Israel. The threat coming from Israeli embassy operatives inside the United States is such that the Department of Defense once warned that Jewish Americans would likely be the targets of intelligence approaches. Israel accelerated its nuclear program after the death of Kennedy. By 1965, it had obtained the raw material for a bomb consisting of U.S. government-owned highly enriched weapons-grade uranium obtained from a company in Pennsylvania called NUMEC, which was founded in 1956 and owned by Zalman Mordecai Shapiro, head of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Zionist Organization of America. NUMEC was a supplier of enriched uranium for government projects, but it was also from the start a front for the Israeli nuclear program, with its chief funder David Lowenthal, a leading Zionist, traveling to Israel at least once a month, where he would meet with an old friend, Meir Amit, who headed Israeli intelligence. NUMEC covered the shipment of enriched uranium to Israel by claiming the metal was lost, losses that totaled nearly 600 pounds, enough to produce dozens of weapons. Such was the importance of the operation that in 1968 NUMEC even received a private incognito visit from spymaster Rafi Eitan. Also, there was physical evidence relating to the diversion of uranium. Refined uranium has a technical signature that permits identification of its source. Traces of uranium from NUMEC were identified by Department of Energy inspectors in Israel in 1978. The Central Intelligence Agency has also looked into the diversion of enriched uranium from the NUMEC plant and has concluded that it was part of a broader program to obtain the technology and raw materials for a nuclear device for Israel. With the uranium in hand, the stealing of the advanced technology needed to make a nuclear weapon is where Milchan comes into the story. Milchan was born in Israel but moved to the United States and eventually wound up as the founder owner of a major movie production company, New Regency Films, in a November 25, 2013 interview on Israeli television. Milchan admitted that he had spent his many years in Hollywood as an agent for Israeli intelligence, helping obtain embargo technologies and materials that enabled Israel to develop a nuclear weapon. He worked for Israel's Bureau of Science and Liaison Acquisition Division of Mossad, referred to as the LACM spy agency. Milchan, a longtime resident of the United States who clearly still has significant business interests in this country as evidenced by Bohemian Rhapsody, explained in his interview, "I did it for my country, and I'm proud of it." He also said that other big Hollywood names were connected to his covert affairs. Among other successes, he obtained through his company Heli Trading 800 Krittens, the sophisticated triggers for nuclear weapons. The devices were acquired from the California top-secret defense contractor Milco International. Milchan personally recruited Milco's president Richard Kelly Smith as an agent before turning him over to another Heli Trading employee, Benjamin Netanyahu, for handling. Smith was eventually arrested in 1985 and cooperated in his interrogation by the FBI before being sentenced to prison, which means that the federal government knew all about both Milchan and Netanyahu at that time but did not even seek to interview them and ultimately did nothing about them. "I would like to think that the next time Milchan arrives at Los Angeles International Airport on business, he will be met by federal marshals and FBI agents before being whisked off to some nice, quiet place for a chat, but don't bet on it." Milchan is possibly no longer traveling regularly to the U.S., though he retains a residence in California, and his confession suggests that he believes himself to be bulletproof. He has also recently been involved in a bit of controversy in Israel itself, where the police have recommended that he be charged with bribery connected with the ongoing investigation of corruption by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Milchan, it seems, spent 1 million shekels, $250,000, on luxury items that he gave to BB as a reported quid pro quo to exempt his substantial income from taxes when he returned to Israel to live in 2013. In an interesting additional element to that story, the police investigation determined that in 2014 Netanyahu approached then Secretary of State John Kerry to intervene and arrange for a long-term American visa for Milchan, who was at the time dealing with difficulties relating to his U.S. status, possibly to add to the 2013 admission that he had been spying. In any event, the visa was granted and Milchan continued to make more movies and money in Los Angeles. The tragedy is that spying for Israel appears to be regarded as something like a victimless crime, but in the case of Milchan it was dead serious, involving as it did nuclear proliferation on behalf of a nation that might generously be described as aggressively paranoid. And note that Netanyahu, the very statesman who received 29 standing ovations from Congress, was also involved in the major Mossad operation to steal from the United States. In fact, even though the Israelis continue to rob America blind, it is extremely difficult to be punished for doing so. Prosecutions for Israeli spying are so few because the Department of Justice is unwilling to pursue them. According to a retired FBI agent who claimed that hundreds of potential prosecutions were rejected for political reasons, the actual convictions involve crimes so egregious that they cannot be ignored or covered up, like conversations overheard at lunch, as when Pentagon analyst Larry Franklin provided intelligence on Iran to American-Israel Public Affairs Committee staffers Keith Weissman and Steve Rosen, as well as to officials in the Israeli embassy. Franklin went briefly to jail and was recently reported to be waiting tables in West Virginia. U.S. Navy analyst Jonathan Pollard, America's most damaging spy of all time, stole enough top-secret code word material to fill a room before he was arrested and convicted. He obtained Israeli citizenship while in prison and is now free on parole, living in New York City. Apart from that, nada, time to change all that. Milchan and others are not friends of the United States but quite the contrary, and deserve to be treated like any other spy. The American people should demand that the government begin to recognize that fact and act accordingly, telling Hollywood that it is not good PR to keep allowing Israeli spy Milchan to make millions is a possibility, But sanctioning him to put him out of business would be an even better place to start. Civil rights award yanked over anti-Semitic remarks but leftists okay with Davis's terrorist background. By St. Patrick, Angela Davis has led a career and a life that has attracted controversies, criticisms, and bans. The most recent was a rescinding of the Fred Shuttlesworth Human Rights Award given by the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, BCRI, citing that Davis's opinions and remarks do not meet all of the criteria on which the award is based. Birmingham Mayor Randall Woodfin decided against the October decision to present the award to Davis. BCRI's decision comes at a time in the nation's history when political correctness and the wildly shifting levels of acceptable speech reach a new, more disturbing apex on what appears on a weekly basis. Davis's new crime of opinion, or thought crime, in the words of 1984 author George Orwell, was that she has been a longtime vocal supporter of Palestinian rights and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, campaign against Israel. BCRI's decision to rescind the award is surprising, as Davis's views on Israeli state policy and the ideology of Zionism are not new. In his 1992 book Chutzpah, attorney Alan Dershowitz famously described Davis's response when he asked her for a public statement in support of a list of political prisoners being held in the USSR. Davis told Dershowitz that none of the people on his list were political prisoners. They are all Zionist fascists and opponents of socialism, Davis explained. Davis, an icon of the 1960s Black Panther Party, has also referred to the Israeli occupation of Palestine and has compared the Israeli treatment of Palestinians to American police shootings of African Americans. She comes from a larger-than-life era where slogans, keywords, and political posters ruled the day. She, like many others from that same era, speaks in anecdotes and analogies. In 1969, Governor Ronald Reagan, R. Califf, attempted to have Davis banned from teaching at California universities because of her affiliation with the Communist Party USA, CPUSA. She was twice a candidate for vice president on the CPUSA ticket in the 1980s when Reagan was president. She left the CPUSA when it supported the Soviets' 1991 August coup attempt. The coup was led by communist hardliners attempting to wrest control from Mikhail Gorbachev. In the new millennium, Davis has worked largely in support of the prison abolition movement. She co-founded Critical Resistance, CR, to build a groundswell of grassroots supporters dedicated to working against the prison industrial complex. CR's efforts are focused on building engaged communities that can educate and heal people rather than caging them. There has been a reflexive reaction by conservatives to support the rescinding of the award. In a parallel story, there has also been conservative, and some liberal, support to admonish Rep. Ilhan Omar, D-min, for her comments explaining both the definition of an Israeli lobby and her criticism of politicians who, for financial reasons, would adhere to the demands of a foreign lobby. President Donald Trump ridiculously called for Omar's resignation. See related story, pages 12-13. Criticizing Davis and Omar is certainly within the bounds of free speech in a constitutional republic. The danger comes in the quick, negative labeling of people and politicians. When Republicans are irrationally labeled as racist, sexist, homophobic, or jingoistic, they rightly balk and demand retractions. So, is the quick labeling of Davis and Omar's anti-Semitic a tit for tat for Republicans wanting to turn the linguistic tables? If it is, it's a petty lesson that will not be learned, no matter how many times it is taught. Instead, mouthpieces from both parties should realize how unconstructive it is to promote labels over arguments and verbal stings over vast solutions. The rescinding of Davis's award was a sloppy public relations faux pas by local politicians who believed they were doing the politically correct thing for the sake of political correctness, to maintain their wholly unoffensive PC cred. Rather, what they did was discover that the game isn't real, and the maneuvers are contrived. Truth is truth and courage is courage, no matter what words are used in their explanations. Who's after Golan Heights riches? Prominent American neocons? State of Israel have eyes on Syrian energy reserves. By Richard Walker. A plan pushed by U.S. senators to recognize Israel's claim to the Golan Heights hides an effort by rich, powerful neocons and their Israeli backers to seize energy riches from what international law declares as part of Syria. Senator Lindsey Graham, RSC, toured the Golan Heights on March 11 with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and declared that the Golan Heights had a rich Jewish history and was part of the State of Israel. Had he checked history books and a map of the region, he would have learned that the Golan Heights are situated in southeastern Syria, bordering the Sea of Galilee, Israel's main source of drinking water. He would also have discovered that they were illegally seized by Israel in the 1967 war and have been illegally occupied ever since. The Golan Heights is therefore not part of the State of Israel and never was. Netanyahu has directed the building of extensive Jewish settlements on the Golan Heights, but it is not the first time Jews have tried to populate the area. In 1894, efforts to colonize the Golan Heights by Jewish banker Edmund D. Rothschild were thwarted by Arabs and Ottoman Empire laws restricting foreigners from settling the area. None of this seems to matter to Graham and Sons, Ted Cruz, R. Texas, and Marco Rubio, R. FLA, the trio at the forefront of arguing that Congress should pass legislation giving Israel the Golan irrespective of international law. In tandem with their effort, the U.S. State Department has stopped referring to the area as Israeli-occupied territory and instead calls it Israeli-controlled territory. Netanyahu, facing criminal prosecution and an upcoming election, would love nothing better than a U.S. declaration that the Golan Heights is now Israel's. His friends in Washington, including President Donald Trump's son-in-law advisor Jared Kushner and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, appear ready to give him that gift. But there is a sinister motive for a sudden gifting of the Golan Heights to Israel, and it has its genesis in plans that took shape years before Trump entered the White House. It concerns a neocon strategy, ongoing now for almost a decade, to access oil and gas riches under the Golan Heights. It began with powerful neocons and their friends in Israel deciding that the best way to get full control of the Golan Heights was to call for regime change in Syria so that there would be no Syrian leadership around to continue petitioning the UN on the issue. Despite many UN resolutions telling Israel to give back the territory, it has refused to do so, with Washington's backing on the Security Council. In recent years, Netanyahu has done everything possible to take down the Assad regime in Syria, even training and arming al-Nusra terrorists. He also ordered hundreds of bombing runs against targets in Syria, arguing that he was eliminating Iranian and Hezbollah forces there. His security issue was a ruse. In 2011, a little known American company called Genie Energy, based in New Jersey, was granted rights to illegally explore 153 square miles of the Golan Heights for oil and gas. It was part of the IDT Corporation until it was registered as a separate entity on the New York Stock Exchange. The membership of Genie Energy's Strategic Advisory Board testified to its neocon lineage. Prominent on the board were Dick Cheney, media mogul Rupert Murdoch, former CIA Director James Woolsey, senior partner in Genie Energy Jacob Lord Rothschild, billionaire hedge funder and member of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies Michael Steinhardt, Bill Clinton's Energy Secretary Bill Richardson, and Larry Summers, Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton. The Israeli subsidiary of Genie is now run by former Israeli General Effi Edom, a close buddy of Netanyahu who lives in one of the large Jewish settlements on the Golan Heights. Edom is an extreme religious figure who has recommended removing all Israeli Arabs from Israel. By 2013, as the war in Syria raged and the U.S. pushed for regime change with Israel's backing, Netanyahu and Genie Energy knew from surveys of the Golan Heights that it held massive energy reserves. It was confirmed by a geologist with Effek Oil and Gas, Genie Energy's Israeli subsidiary. With Trump in the White House, there has been a renewed push by Genie Energy and its Israeli backers to convince members of the Senate to change policy on the Golan Heights to favor Israel, claiming it is Israeli Jewish territory and is therefore strategic to the defense of the State of Israel. Missing from the storyline is the massive wealth waiting to be snapped up. Ryan Zinke, Trump's former Interior Secretary, who is under federal investigation, knew about the energy potential in the Golan Heights when he visited the region in 2017. He met with Edom, who was then a politician running AFEC. Edom said their meeting had been arranged by a friend in Montana, and that they never discussed energy issues, a story few believed. It's unlikely the backstory of Genie Energy will dissuade anyone in the Senate or the White House from doing Netanyahu's bidding, especially after Graham declared that the Golan Heights was already part of the State of Israel and had a rich Jewish history. He deliberately ignored the fact that it is illegally occupied territory with a rich Syrian Arab history. Green Energy badly failed recent polar vortex tests. Wind turbines actually consumed power in Arctic blast, by Richard McCarty. The polar vortex of extremely cold weather this winter severely tested the newly proposed Green New Deal policies, and we now know that these policies failed miserably. Many Democrats, including U.S. Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, DNY, and several presidential candidates, support a Green New Deal, which would phase out the use of all coal, natural gas, and oil and replace them with green energy. Proving just how wrong-headed those policies are, solar and wind power performed very poorly during the storm, while coal, natural gas, and nuclear power helped keep the lights and heat on for the vast majority of people. Just how bad was green energy's performance during the storm? In an area stretching from Minnesota to Iowa, wind turbines went from supplying about half of the electricity one day to providing less than 3% the next, at a time when people needed energy the most. What caused this dramatic swing in energy output? Most turbines automatically shut down once temperatures reach minus 20 degrees F. Even worse, not only did the turbines stop producing power, they actually started to consume power for heat to avoid damage. Solar energy production also collapsed. Due to snow cover, Xcel Energy solar panels only produced 8% to 10% of their potential output. In addition to the massive problems with green energy production, there were also some problems with natural gas. Natural gas-powered plants were hampered in their effort to generate more electricity due, in part, to freeze-offs. Freeze-offs occur in cold weather when water and other liquids freeze at natural gas wells, and they can cause natural gas shortages and price spikes. Freeze-offs are just one more reason why more pipelines are needed, but the left still opposes them. Because of the energy production problems, businesses and consumers were asked to reduce their energy use. This is called demand response. For example, Xcel Energy asked some Minnesota residents to turn down their thermostats to 55 degrees F. Other Minnesotans were asked to turn down their heat to 63 degrees F. The Michigan governor asked most state residents to turn down their thermostats to 65 degrees F. In response to requests like these, GM shuttered 13 facilities, Fiat Chrysler closed 2 plants, Ford cut back production at 3 facilities. Environmentalists seem to think that demand response is a perfectly fine way to deal with extremely cold weather. Of course, this overlooks the fact that workers at shutdown businesses might need their missing wages, and that some people, including many of the elderly, get cold easily, so turning their heat down is more than a minor inconvenience. The goal should be to build a robust electric grid that is capable of meeting demand on the hottest summer days and the coldest winter nights, with additional reserves to cover contingencies. Just planning to have sufficient power to handle normal circumstances and then urging people to muddle through harsh weather in the northern U.S. is not acceptable. To deal with the intermittent supply of solar and wind power, some green energy supporters want to connect regional grids into a national grid. By connecting the regional grids, grid operators would have more options for avoiding outages and dealing with excess energy. While a national grid may or may not be a good idea, environmentalists often oppose the high voltage lines that would likely be used to connect the regional grids. The facts are clear from the polar vortex. Even in the worst of conditions, coal and nuclear power are reliable. Natural gas is less so, but it is still fairly reliable. On the other hand, green energy is still unreliable, and depending upon it is foolish and dangerous. Of course, liberals will learn nothing from this storm and will continue to push for the costly Green New Deal to protect lives and our economy. These policies must be defeated. Do we know what spawned the Christchurch massacre? By Patrick J. Buchanan. On March 15, in Christchurch, New Zealand, one of the more civilized places on earth, 28-year-old Brenton Tarrant, an Australian, turned on his cell phone camera and set out to live stream his massacre of as many innocent Muslim worshippers as he could kill. Using a semi-automatic rifle, he murdered more than 40 men, women, and children at one mosque, drove 3 miles to another, and there killed more, 50 in all. Dozens are still wounded, suffering, and dying. An atrocity, an act of pure evil by a man with a dead soul. Yet, predictably, within 48 hours, the President of the United States was being publicly indicted as a moral accomplice. Donald Trump, it was said, used a word, invasion, to describe the 76,000 migrants caught illegally crossing the U.S. border in February. At the same time, the killer used that word to describe the Muslim migration into the West. The killer also mentioned Trump in his 74-page manifesto. What further need have we of proof? Trump also failed to express America's revulsion and his country's condolences to Muslims everywhere, and failed to denounce the white nationalist ideology that motivated the killer. From there, it was a short jump to declare that we Americans have too long ignored this growing menace. Charlottesville, where a woman protester was run over by a neo-Nazi, was trotted out again and again. But does the vision of America as a country where white racism is rampant and an unleashed white nationalism is a scourge that is running amok correspond with reality? America's elites are familiar with the Acela Express, the train that runs from D.C.'s Union Station to Penn Station in New York. In which of the 5 eastern seaboard cities at which the Acela stops to take on and discharge passengers? Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Newark, New York. Are white nationalists responsible for a significant share of the assaults, robberies, rapes, and shootings? Chicago may lead the nation in total gun deaths, but the murder rate was highest in 2018 in St. Louis, Baltimore, Detroit, New Orleans, and Kansas City. In how many of these cities are Klansmen and neo-Nazis regularly hauled in for violent crimes? As for the mass murders of our new century, the racist right has perpetrated its share. Dylann Roof's killing of the black women and men at the Charleston church qualifies, as does the massacre of Jews at the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh. Yet a Muslim major, Nidal Hassan, fatally shot 13 soldiers at Fort Hood. In the 2015 San Bernardino massacre, Syed Farrakh and Tashfeen Malik carried out that attack that left 14 dead and 22 wounded, according to Forbes. Of the 18,814 deaths caused by terrorists around the world in 2017, well over half were due to the actions of 4 groups: Islamic State, the Taliban, Al-Shabaab, and Boko Haram. All are Sunni Muslim. None are alt-right. Undeniably, atrocities that exceed in bloodshed the street. Valentine's Day massacre by Al Capone's gang, where 7 men were stood against a wall in a Chicago garage and executed, have become all too common. But the atrocities seized upon by the left as most representative are those that conform to vision, a narrative, a pre-existing script. This preconceived idea is that America is a hotbed of white nationalism where the worst crimes are committed by white racists, and this is a myth. Now, there are no excuses, or defenses, for what happened in Christchurch, but there is an explanation. All peoples to some degree resent and resist the movement of outsiders into their space. Some migrants are more difficult than others to assimilate into Western societies. European nations that had not known mass migrations for centuries were especially susceptible to a virulent reaction, a backlash. Americans, after all, reacted viscerally to the Irish migration of 1845, 1849, and, again, to the Great Migration from Central and Eastern Europe from 1890 to 1920. Interethnic violence was not uncommon. Our leaders in the 1920s understood this and took steps to halt the migrations until those who had come could be assimilated and, in a word, Americanized. It worked. By 1960, we were a united people. Then, without the people's consent, the great experiment began. America's doors were thrown open to peoples of every religion, race, culture, and creed, to create a different nation that mirrored all mankind in its diversity. In author and commentator Ben Wattenberg's phrase, a universal nation. The problem, a universal nation is a contradiction in terms. A nation of all races, religions, and tribes had never before existed. The liberal democracies that embraced this ideology, this idea, are at war with human nature, and are losing this war to tribalism and authoritarianism. As for Christchurch, unfortunately, such horrors appear to have become the new normal, but Brenton Tarrant alone is responsible for what he did, and it was not Trump but the New World Order globalists who fertilized the soil that spawned him. Take the guns first, worry about the process later, says Trump. Bipartisan attacks against Second Amendment are troubling. By Dr. Ron Paul, the U.S. House of Representatives recently passed legislation that would expand the national background check system to require almost everyone selling firearms, including private collectors who supplement their incomes by selling firearms at gun shows, to perform background checks on potential buyers. The bill has a section purporting to bar creation of a national firearms registry. However, the expanded background check system will require the government to compile lists of those buying and selling guns. In other words, it creates a de facto national gun registry, similar to the experience with other types of prohibition. Making it more difficult to legally buy a gun will enhance the firearms black market. Criminals, terrorists, and even deranged mass shooters will thus have no problem obtaining firearms. It is no coincidence that the majority of mass shootings take place in gun-free zones, where shooters know their targets will be unarmed. This shows that any law making it more difficult for Americans to own and carry firearms makes us less safe. If Congress really wanted to reduce the incidence of gun violence, it would repeal the Gun-Free School Zones Act. This law leaves children easy prey for mass shooters by mandating that public schools be gun-free zones. A nationwide system of gun registration could be a step toward national gun confiscation. However, anti-gun bureaucrats need not go that far to use the expanded background check system to abuse the rights of gun owners. Gun owners could find themselves subject to surveillance and even harassment, such as more intensive screening by the Transportation Security Administration, because they own too many firearms. Republican control of the White House and the Senate does not mean our gun rights are safe. Republicans have a long history of supporting gun control. After the 1999 Columbine shooting, many Republicans, including many who campaigned as being pro-Second Amendment, eagerly cooperated with then-President Bill Clinton on gun control. Some supposedly pro-gun Republicans also tried to pass compromise gun control legislation after the Sandy Hook shooting. Neoconservative Senator Marco Rubio, RFLA, has introduced legislation that uses tax dollars to bribe states to adopt red flag laws. Red flag laws allow government to violate an individual's Second Amendment rights based on nothing more than a report that the individual could become violent. Red flag laws can allow an individual's guns to be taken away without due process simply because an estranged spouse, angry neighbor, or disgruntled co-worker tells police the individual threatened him or otherwise made him feel unsafe. President Donald Trump has joined Rubio in wanting the government to, in Trump's words, take the guns first, go through the process second. During his confirmation hearing, Trump's new Attorney General William Barr expressed support for red flag laws. Leading gun control advocate Senator Dianne Feinstein, DeKalb, has expressed interest in working with Barr to deprive gun owners of the process. It would not be surprising to see left-wing authoritarians like Feinstein work with right-wing authoritarians like Barr and Rubio on compromise legislation containing both a national red flag law and expanded background checks. My years in Congress taught me that few politicians can be counted on to protect our liberties. Most politicians must be pressured to stand up for freedom by informed and involved pro-liberty citizens. That is why those of us who understand the benefits of liberty must remain vigilant against any attempt to erode respect for our rights, especially the right to defend ourselves against private crime and public tyranny. Trump's bloated budget, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, by Mark Anderson. The $4.7 trillion 2020 budget request released March 11 by the White House entitled A Budget for a Better America, Promises Kept, Taxpayers First seeks to fulfill several of President Donald Trump's campaign pledges such as strengthening border defense and immigration policy, spending more for veterans' health care, and boosting military spending. Interestingly, the spending plan also would require universities receiving federal funds to bear part of the burden servicing student loans, and, among other things, the plan, which still must go through Congress and applies to the fiscal year which begins October 1st, would curb wasteful spending while predicting a balanced budget by 2034, based on a projected $2.7 trillion in spending cuts, higher than any other administration in history, the White House claims. Regarding the border, a White House press release on the budget notes, the federal government must employ all lawful means to enforce the immigration laws of the United States and reduce the flow of illegal aliens and illegal drugs into the country. The budget requests the resources necessary to continue constructing physical barriers on the border, and increases the manpower of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and Customs and Border Protection. The plan seeks $5 billion from the Homeland Security budget and $3.6 billion from military construction funds for the border wall's continuation and another $3.6 billion for military construction to replace money Trump intends to shift this year to border wall construction. In a related matter, the budget request proposes policy changes to end sanctuary cities. The press release added, "This poses a challenge to ultra-liberal mayors in some of the nation's largest cities who've helped illegal immigrants, including those suspected of serious crimes, avoid capture. As for veterans care, although ending America's interventionist military policy altogether would stem the flow of maimed and mentally unstable veterans," the White House did announce. "The president's budget invests over $80 billion to ensure our veterans receive world-class health care, a nearly a 10% increase from FY 2019 levels. In addition, the budget makes significant investments in veteran rehabilitation services, education and employment assistance, and suicide prevention. Student loan debt, which cannot be nullified under bankruptcy laws, has entangled college-educated Americans with large, long-term payments and heavy interest charges, forcing many adults to move back home with their parents and work multiple jobs that often are well below the pay grade for which they were educated, and while allowing financially strapped college attendees more leeway to challenge the validity in terms of student loans would be ideal." The budget plan does take some initial positive steps. The budget proposes to hold institutions of higher education accountable for results by requiring colleges and universities to share a portion of the financial responsibility associated with federal student loans to encourage them to improve performance, it notes. Other budget features include a one-time, mandatory investment of $1 billion for a competitive fund aimed at supporting underserved populations and stimulating employer investments in child care for working families, paid leave for working parents, investments in prevention, treatment, research, and recovery to combat the opioid epidemic, cuts in some mandatory programs. Medicaid would be partly transformed into a grant program. Crop insurance supports would be cut and $200 billion would be saved via the student loan changes, rooting out Medicare waste, netting $456 billion over 10 years. The budget also calls for spending $750 billion on the military with increased funding for SPASA-based weapons and artificial intelligence. Trump's budget letter also informed Congress that the White House seeks to fund what are known as the National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy. The 35-page National Security Strategy of 2002, published by the State Department, notes, "We will actively work to bring the hope of democracy, development, free markets, and free trade to every corner of the world," softly but clearly confirming that a George W. Bush or any conservative posture of exporting democracy, even from the end of a gun, remains in place. Insider reveals more Clinton corruption transcripts of Lisa Page testimony released, Hillary incompetent, Obama crooked, by Donald Jeffries, ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee Rep. Doug Collins, RGA. On March 12, made public the official transcript of former FBI lawyer Lisa Page's July 2018 closed-door testimony before Congress. It included the bombshell revelation that the Obama Justice Department had ordered the FBI to not charge Hillary Clinton with gross negligence in her mishandling of classified information. Page described multiple conversations led by Attorney General Loretta Lynch about the subject but testified that the department felt it could not sustain a charge against the former Secretary of State. As might be anticipated, President Donald Trump quickly took to Twitter, responding, "The just-revealed FBI agent Lisa Page transcripts make the Obama Justice Department look exactly like it was, a broken and corrupt machine. Hopefully, justice will finally be served. Much more to come." Page is hardly a Trump zealot. She was one of those tasked with investigating the fanciful connections between the Russians and Trump. Anti-Trump text messages between Page and fellow FBI agent Peter Strzok were, in fact, publicized and caused the Bureau great embarrassment. The texts were sent on government phones, and in the midst of both Page and Strzok supposedly independently investigating collusion, and also while they engaged in an extramarital love affair. A May 19, 2017 text from Strzok to Page said, "You and I both know the odds are nothing. If I thought it was likely, I'd be there no question. There's no big there, and was sent only 2 days after Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein appointed Special Counsel Robert Mueller," Page admitted, in the same private congressional testimony, that this text was in reference to the supposed Russian collusion case. In another text, Strzok raised the subject of impeachment. Page quickly reined him in, texting back, "We should stop having this conversation here." Page also expressed her clear fear of Hillary Clinton in an earlier February 2016 text to Strzok, warning him, "She might be our next president. The last thing you need is us going in there loaded for bear. You think she's going to remember or care that it was more Dodge than FBI?" The animosity both FBI agents held toward Trump was best reflected in a desperate 2016 text from Page, figuratively screaming that Trump was not ever going to become president. Right? Strzok confidently responded, No, he won't. We'll stop it." Strzok would later be fired by the FBI and Page would resign. Their anti-Trump bias is significant, not only because of their work on Russian collusion, but because they both also worked on the FBI's woeful investigation into Hillary Clinton's missing emails. Collins explained to reporters why he released the transcript of Page's testimony. "The president has been unfairly attacked from the moment he was elected in November 2016 on many fronts, and now we're beginning just to see the vast scope of what most of us knew, that Mrs. Clinton was treated completely differently than what we ended up seeing Trump being treated, and that's just wrong. This just shows that there's a two-tiered system." Lynch had memorably met with Bill Clinton privately on an airport tarmac only 5 days before the FBI interviewed Hillary Clinton about the emails. Laughably, Lynch attributed the discussion to a great deal about grandchildren. "It was primarily social. There was no discussion on any matter pending before the department, no discussion of State Department emails." Further details from Page's closed-door testimony are illuminating as well. Representatives like South Carolina's Trey Gowdy were very interested in Strzok's August 2016 text to Page, in which he stated, "I want to believe the path you threw out in Andy's, McCabe's, office, that there's no way he gets elected, but I'm afraid we can't take the risk. It's like an insurance policy in the unlikely event you die before you're 40. McCabe would respond by saying he didn't recall discussing such an insurance policy with Strzok and Page. Page also expressed the Bureau's belief that Trump would never be elected, testifying, "So this reflects, let's be reasonable, let's not, you know, throw the kitchen sink at this because he's probably not going to be elected, and so then we don't have quite as horrific a national security threat than if we do if he gets elected." Some conservative outlets, such as the Washington Examiner, declared that Page's testimony might result in the Department of Justice reopening an investigation into Hillary Clinton. While Roger Stone was subjected to a pre-dawn SWAT team raid at his home, Jerome Carsey remains subject to possible prosecution, and Paul Manafort has been sentenced to 7 years in prison. Hillary Clinton, Lynch, and other swamp creatures remain free. Will there now be new, louder calls to lock her up? Former Nevada Senator Jess Fenster Damore UFO Research Read says it's time for people to know what government knows, by S.T. Patrick. Located to north of Las Vegas, Lincoln County is one of Nevada's largest and most sparsely populated counties, with a population barely surpassing 5,000. Lincoln County, the seventh largest county in America in land area, does not seem like a bustling metropolis of activity. There are no colleges, no professional sports franchises, no Walmart stores, and few gas stations. A common sight along Route 93 that traverses the county is a faded blue sign that reads "Next Gas 91 miles." But for close to 30 years now, Lincoln County has been the international hub for UFO enthusiasts as Groom Dry Lake, popularly known as Area 51, is located in the heart of this desert county. Former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, DNEV, is among the Silver State's most widely known politicians. As the majority leader through much of the Obama years, Reid was privy to the high-level security concerns of America's post-9/11 society. Now, as reported by Class TV's George Knapp, Reid is calling for formal congressional hearings to study the government's investigations into UFOs. "I personally don't know if there exists little green men other places. I kind of doubt that, but I do believe that the information we have indicates we should get a lot more study," Nevada's most well-known Democrat said. "We have hundreds and hundreds of people that have seen the same thing, something in the sky. It moves a certain way." Many will question Reid's qualifications and his sanity, despite the fact that, until 2012, he led a secret Pentagon study of UFOs that was based in Las Vegas. In December 2017, The New York Times reported on the AATIP program that had been created to study the UFO phenomena. The AATIP, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, was the brainchild of Reid and two colleagues in the Senate. It spawned an offshoot, the Advanced Aerospace Weapons Systems Application Program, AAWSAP. Neither discusses UFOs openly, or even by name, but Reid admits that it would take some naivete to just blindly ignore the accumulation of existing stories reported by highly qualified aerospace and aviation professionals regarding the origin of whatever unidentified flying objects have been reported. Reid is leery about venturing a guess about something still unknown. "We do not know," Reid said. "What I have learned is, you can't just hide your head in the sand and say these things are not happening. We have military installations where hundreds and hundreds of people who are there see these things." Another senator highly interested in the research was Senator John McCain, R.A.R.S. As the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, McCain had requested all available materials from AATIP. "Sure, John knew what I was doing," Reid said of the late McCain. "He didn't hide the fact that he was interested." Also, Reid's former deputy, Senator Richard Durbin, DEAL, is now the ranking member of the Defense Appropriations Committee. The Defense Committee's interest has been piqued, and Reid has his most formidable contacts within those industries. While scientists in the typically cranky mainstream media have derided using government funds to research fringe science, Reid appears dedicated to the value of the work still being done at the various levels of government. One of the more mysterious and fascinating publications undertaken by AATIP concerned research into the invisibility cloaking of aircraft. The Pentagon seems very interested in the possibility of producing aircraft completely invisible to radar, but that, however, has been a project ongoing for 50 plus years. The Pentagon, the released files show us now, is also very interested in the possibility that aircraft can be made literally invisible. "There are certainly practical effects of these studies. Any study into hypersonic speed, air tracking, and cloaking can also be applied to tracking missiles." For example, how important has this field of research become for Reid? By law, U.S. senators are barred from lobbying the legislative branch for 2 years after leaving office. That probationary period ended for Reid in January. Since then, he has been lobbying key Washington, D.C. insiders about UFOs and projects that have to date been shrouded in mystery. "The danger for the American people, and, really, the world, is that this is, in itself, a shrouded program. And if it is, who would be surprised?" Just 6 months after the Times released news of the program, President Donald Trump announced Space Force and called upon its establishment as the sixth military branch. The most systematically skeptical demographic on the political scene are those who read and watch alternative media. On its face, the idea is one amiable to even the most hardcore skeptics who have long wished for some acknowledgement of disclosure regarding UFOs. The skepticism and care that needs to be maintained with Reed's work concerns further militarizing space and using this research and Space Force to digest that. In essence, there is the possibility that the UFO question is the Hollywoodization of what may be a much more sinister program. There is hope that the Reed revelations are a step in the right direction in the field of ufology. If the program is solely for military purposes, it will not discredit the UFO sightings that have been logged by aerospace and aviation professionals. But if the program is a genuine acceptance of a more open policy regarding UFOs, then we may just find out that the truth is out there. After all, QAnon book exposes deep state agenda powers that be want Americans divided so we won't unite against them. By Donald Jeffries, the book QAnon, An Invitation to the Great Awakening, written by a group under the collective pseudonym WWG1WGA, short for QS Credo Where We Go One We Go All, was released on February 26. To say that it has shocked the world of publishing would be a severe understatement. It has already garnered an astounding 463 reviews and soared as high as number 4 overall in Amazon's sales rankings. This was in spite of the fact that Q supporters such as podcast radio host Jenny Hatch charged, purchasers are being denied the ability to leave both video and text reviews. I purchased the book this morning and tried 3 times to leave a review and was not allowed. I also uploaded a 3-minute video that was rejected by Amazon. The book quickly caught the attention of the mainstream media, who attacked it with headlines like Canon Book claiming Democrats eat children is climbing the Amazon charts. NBC News echoed this with a March 4 story that bemoaned how the book was currently one slot ahead of Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 in sales ranking, declaring that the book claims without evidence a variety of outlandish claims including that prominent Democrats murder and eat children and that the U.S. government created both AIDS and the movie Monsters Incorporated. The story also emphatically stated, adherents of the QAnon conspiracy theory falsely believe that the world is run by a satanic cabal helmed by former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, and that President Donald Trump and special counsel Robert Mueller secretly working in tandem to eliminate the cabal. Vox explained that the book's astonishing success rewards quick purchases and fervent reviews, not quality content. Outlets like The Hill grilled Amazon, which declined to comment, regarding the controversial book's placement on its bestseller list. The QAnon phenomenon has divided most of the alternative right, with an impressive number of hardcore believers on one side, and an equal number of skeptics on the other. QAnon, An Invitation to the Great Awakening, in the words of one Amazon reviewer of the book, provides a gentle way for uninformed normies to find out what is really going on within the political class that have been ruling over us for decades. Some adherents believe that Q is, in fact, John F. Kennedy Jr., who faked his death and has gone on to work behind the scenes with his old friend Donald Trump, with a shared goal of draining the swamp. Promoters of Q often dismiss doubters with the standard advice to trust the plan. Those who think Q is some kind of hoax point out the litany of predictions about mass arrests and the like that didn't transpire on the dates predicted, and, of course, some point out Trump's perfect record of selecting nothing but swamp creatures for his administration and his backtracking and inconsistency on issues like immigration and ending U.S. involvement in other countries. QAnon was a hot topic on the popular website Reddit, but they banned a discussion board related to QAnon titled Great Awakening in September 2018. Reddit also banned 17 other QAnon-focused communities, allegedly because of unspecified threats of violence from Q proponents. Popular YouTube channel host Justin Nemes is one of those involved with putting the Great Awakening book together. Nemes told his writer, "I'm simply stunned by the tremendous outpouring of love and patriotism surrounding this book. It shows that the time is ready for the truth to win out over the fake news. I'm humbled to have been part of this collaboration. The synopsis for the book provided by the authors explains, Kanan, an invitation to the Great Awakening tells the history of an anonymous poster on the free speech websites 4chan and NHN and how he, or perhaps they, built a following of millions of viewers worldwide, with an insider's knowledge of the battle plan, and Q-level military intelligence clearance. QAnon's communications are often cryptic and coded. QAnon is a master of the Socratic method, asking questions and imploring followers to do their own research, to be logical and to think for themselves. However one views QAnon, no reasonable person can disagree with the sentiments expressed in an October 5, 2018 Q drop, which advised, they want you divided, divided by race, divided by religion, divided by culture, divided by class, divided by political affiliation, divided you are weak, together you are strong. This movement challenges their forced narrative. This movement challenges people to not simply trust what is being reported. Research for yourself, think for yourself, trust yourself. This movement is not about one person or a group of people. We, the people, save the Republic.